On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Poet, screenwriter, and novelist Jim Harrison writes in the old style of big appetites, big passions, earthy love, men's men, and the woods. He did it in Legends of the Fall, the novella that put a young Brad Pitt on the big screen wrestling the bear in the rugged Montana West. He's done it again and again in the deep woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, up toward Sault Ste. Marie, along the Great Lakes, where the Chippewa mixed with immigrant Finns and Swedes. In his latest novel, Returning to Earth, Jim Harrison's broad-shouldered, part Chippewa hero is dying, a good man with a good wife, yearning to leave what matters to the ones he loves and to die his way. Joining me now from Denver is Jim Harrison. He's author of 28 books, 8 novels, including True North, A Good Day to Die, Wolf, and The Road Home. His new novel is Returning to Earth. Jim Harrison, thanks a lot for being with us.
You're welcome. 200 knot winds here of orange dust, but other than that, it's fine.
Okay. We're glad you're with us. And this novel is, again, set like your early work in the terrain of your youth, Upper Peninsula, Michigan. I spent a lot of time in Wisconsin and Michigan, Minnesota, up in the Lake Country, but not the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I wish you'd just describe the setting for us here, Jim.
Well, it's a much more remote area, and it's by far the least populated part of Michigan. It's up above the Straits of Mackinac and borders to the north Lake Superior and then to the south Lake Michigan. But it's mostly wooded. Parts of it are quite lovely, and other parts not so much. It's been pretty much logged over and mined.
Right up against...
There's still some iron and copper being mined, but it's mostly pulp cutting, you know.
I guess you could say mined by Jim Harrison as well. I mean, this was the landscape, the culture of your youth you've gone back to again and again, and again this time.
Well, yes, I feel at home there, and the stories in our dream life tend to come out of our own topography. You know, that's what resonates with us, is our home ground, as it were.
We're getting you pretty loud and clear here. I wish you'd take us into the story that you're telling in your new book, Returning to Earth. Jim, can you lay out the basics of it for us?
Well, the point is that it's the same people as True North, but this novel exists independently. And Donald, who married Cynthia, was the sister of the daughter of the predatory family. She ran off with this half Anishinaabe or Chippewa boy when she was 16. Mm-hmm. And they got married and had a nice life. The brother left behind didn't have such a nice life. But Donald has Lou Gehrig's disease. He's in his mid-40s, and he wants to tell their two children about his own background. So he goes way back to his great-grandfather, who rode a draft horse east from Minnesota back to the UP. It took him 35 years to get there, but he made it.
That's so a big, slow horse.
It's the past of these people. Well, he was 12 years old when he started, you know. Mm-hmm. He was an orphan boy, mm-hmm, who was half Icelandic and half Chippewa. What happens up there is when the loggers and miners moved into that area, there weren't enough women to go around, so many of them married Indian women. So the UP there are a great number of mixed-blood people up there.
Mm. And by the time we meet Donald, he's moving into the last throes of Lou Gehrig's disease, a time when this man who, as many of your male characters, exercised all kinds of big appetites and big muscles in his life. His wife, Cynthia, you have call him, she said, Donald is the most purely physical person I've ever met in my life, and she means it as a compliment, when all that is being robbed from him.
Well, yes, that's the nature of that disease. You know, the utilization is really complete. You know, it's always a fatal sentence, as you know. And but the decline is gradual. With some people, it's rather fast. With others, it takes several years. But his is moving along fast, partly because he couldn't admit it at first, like so many people up there. I mean, I know people up there that even pull their own teeth, you know. They don't have enough money for dentists, and they drink a bottle of whiskey and jerk the bad teeth. So these are tough customers.
People who pull their own teeth. That sounds like Jim Harrison's kind of people, and I want to talk about that. But
well,
I wonder.
I'm not so sure. I'm a whining writer. I would never pull my own teeth.
Yeah, but you sure celebrate those big, muscular, tough guys. There's a passage I wonder if you might read for us, Jim, early on here, where Donald, part Finn, part Iceland, part Chippewa, is now bedridden. He's sort of telling his story through his good wife, Cynthia. And he's acknowledging his physical state and thinking back to what he was. Could you read from there for us?
Yes. I looked down and took the sheet off, and my muscles are nearly gone. Cynthia says not, but I know otherwise. Even a pencil or a glass of water weighs something now. For 25 years, I made a fair living laying blocks, pouring and finishing cement, and sometimes roughing in houses. Now I have too much spit, and I don't want to eat. On Sugar Island, I used to carry the rowboat down to the river for the kids, and it weighed 300 pounds. I would hold out an arm, and my little daughter would swing on it like a monkey. I could hold a 90-pound corner block out straight, and now I can scarcely hold my arm out. These things happen to people, but some days it can be hard to handle. So this morning, my reality broke down. I wasn't sure of anything. Just before I got sick, I finally made a 3-day fast, which I failed at 4 times before it succeeded. What you do is go up into Ontario to a certain mountainside and spend 3 days without food, shelter, or water. I'm not going to talk about my religion because it's too private. Maybe a little. There's another hill from which you can see Lake Superior, where I'm going to be buried. You can't think of a thing that lives that's not going to die. I'd hoped in these 3 days to find out how I was going to get rid of my fears and how to grow older with grace. I found out in a hurry. Here I am, on my way.
Donald, telling his story through his wife, Cynthia, in Jim Harrison's new novel, Returning to Earth, and she makes a note in the text there as the kind of transcription. She says, after that, Donald is now laughing. It takes courage to laugh until you cry at death. Not the first time death has shown up in your work, but it's really the focus this time, sort of approaching it, thinking about it, trying to manage it even in decline. What turned you to this theme this time, Jim Harrison?
Well, I'm getting older myself, and I've had a lot of death in my family, but it seems sort of the death is the unacknowledged legislator of the world, not poetry, you know. So I think, as opposed to Europe, we tend to treat it like a surprise. And it's I wanted to see how I could, if possible, make a family do the whole thing rather gracefully. You know, and in this case, it's borne out by the nature of their characters, you know, that they could finally accept what was happening to the man that they believed the noblest amongst them, you know.
The noblest amongst them in Jim Harrison's world being that kind of big man, strong man, big appetites man. I guess that makes the death seem
well. That's
all the
not
more.
That's not as true in the sense that I've written a number of novels, in the voice of the woman.
Yeah.
But in this case, I wanted to show. You know, you've seen that phenomenon where former really first-rate athletes what happens to them mentally when their bodies begin to disintegrate for one reason or another. Mm. It's a kind of total puzzlement that this human tool they owned no longer would do what it did before. Mm. So I suppose one thing that does pervade Donald's character is puzzlement, because his father was very physical. He was the yard man for this wealthy family of the Burkitts. But it's the nature of the culture. Everyone's pretty much physical because that's the way most people earn their living. Mm. You know, there aren't very many jobs for suits up there.
And here we've got here we've got the son of the yard man who married the daughter of the rich employer, and they go to a very physical, very rich relationship. It's partly about death, and we'll talk about that, but it's also about qualities of mourning. We're talking this hour with poet, screenwriter, and novelist Jim Harrison, author of Legends of the Fall and True North, about deep love, living well, and accepting death in his new novel, Returning to Earth, set in Chippewa country in the upper peninsula of Michigan, up there across the water, up along Lake Superior, right up tucked into the underbelly of Canada there. Let me take a call from Michelle in Nashua, New Hampshire. Michelle, you're on the air with Jim Harrison.
Hello.
Hi.
Jim Harrison, I am someone who is facing end-of-life issues.
Yeah.
And I am quite young and trying to face these in this society, which is, I believe, handling death issues like we did cancer many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It is whispered about in back rooms, but it is not something people feel able to discuss.
And you're facing it yourself, Michelle.
Yes, I am. It is very current. I think there is about a month wherein I can perform at my rather high amount or high bar, but with surgery it could be just a few months or maybe a few years. I am faced with making decisions that discuss how much agony the medical profession and good caring people expect one to suffer to lengthen life or perhaps lengthen suffering. So I'm very attuned to your discussion.
Michelle, is it turning you into a medical expert, into a mystic? There's an element of that in Jim's book here.
Yes. I am a student of Buddhism, and so I am a de facto atheist, and because of that, I do not have a format of what people in this country would say is God intervening or God having a grand plan.
Michelle, this is interesting because I remember when I was first very much a nickel-plated Zen student 35, 40 years ago, there's this passage in Hakuin that says to imagine your death every morning, and that before you do zazen, imagine your death, and then when it comes, it's not going to be any great surprise. I don't know if you were involved in that, because when Jim Welch, my friend, the Native American or Blackfeet writer, died a couple years ago, and I talked to him a week before his death, and I put my arm around him, and he said, "Oh, Jim, don't be upset. These things happen to people." but then he had the particular ammunition, you would say, of a traditional culture, you know, Blackfeet Indian. So some of us are left a bit high and dry, depending on how we prepared or how we thought about the eventuality of such a thing, you know.
Yes.
Michelle, we wish you a good path, and we're glad you joined us. We'll take it on with Jim and hope there's something in it for you as well. Check out the book, Returning to Earth.
Definitely.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Jim, you go often to, I mean, there's the Blackfeet you're talking about. In the book, it's the Chippewa. sort of when the, I don't mean the pun, but when the chips are down, when it really comes to life's bottom line issues, we have, this is not the first time we find Jim Harrison in the company of First People, of Native Americans. What puts your feet on that path?
Well, it's just who I spent so much time around. You write about the people you know to a certain extent. And here, there's the decided contrast of the four sections of the novel. One's in the voice of David, and then the other three are decidedly white folks, right, like the rest of us. Mm. So it's partly the storyteller's urge to give a different point of view. Mm.
Just to have that kind of perspective in our ear, if you'll humor us for a second, I want to listen to just a few seconds from the film version, 1994, of Legends of the Fall, Jim. Here's toward the end of that film, Tristan, played by Brad Pitt. He's alone in the forests of Montana. He's fought a lot of battles, and his encounter on this day will be with a bear. It'll be his last. The second time in his life he's come face-to-face with a bear in Jim Harrison's imagining. Here, Tristan's long-time Native American friend, One Stab, narrates that final passage.
Tristan died in 1963 in the moon of the popping trees. He was last seen up in the north country where the hunting was still good. His grave is unmarked, but it does not matter. He had always lived in the borderland anyway, somewhere between this world and the other.
Jim Harrison, there was a tremendous response to that movie. I know some people who still watch it over and over, and I mean, many reasons for that. But this Native American piece that keeps drawing non-Native Americans in, how do you describe or see the magnetism of that Native American perspective?
Well, it's just because it's so honest and on the money. It's what Faulkner referred to, this is the raw meat on the floor. In other words, there's nothing evasive about it, and something we all know to be true, you know, as we sense to be an absolutely true viewpoint, but we spend much of our life evading that elemental aspect of it, you know.
Do you mind talking about Donald's death in the book? It occurs before we're very far into it, and it's got a very Native American cast to it, more so than his family might have foreseen.
Well, no, of course not, because, you know, it's interesting. I wouldn't say, I utterly disbelieve in any concepts of ethnic or genetic virtue. I mean, that's what's gotten mm-hmm. the world into such a mess in the first place. And of all the natives I know, or American Indians, I don't think any greater proportion of them have a profound religious feelings than, say, we do. But those that do, I mean, it's in your face. You sense it 100 feet away. As Michelle, a questioner, it's like when you meet a particular Zen Roshi and you think you've never met a person so much in one place, you know. They've found themselves where they already are, so their personalities aren't dissipated in the past or the future. You know, they're right where they are. Well, that's the kind of character Donald is, you know, and there's all this talk now about passing laws, plus or minus, pro or con, about euthanasia, but this is Donald's particular experience is beyond.
He has his family, his friends, take him back to the side of that vision that he fasted to when he was much younger. He has the grave dug. He has it lined with cedar boughs. He has them help him cross over.
Yeah, well, of course, that's who should be there, is your family and your children. But, I mean, you can't question his right to do such a thing because, as I said, he's under this preposterously urgent death sentence anyway, you know, and this is the right way to go.
Let me take a call from Sumter, South Carolina, if I may. Rachel, you're on the air with Jim Harrison.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you both.
Great to have you.
I just wanted to tell you, Jim, that you are among my three favorite authors, which are you, Louise Erdrich, and Harry Cruz. And the first of your books that I read was Dalva, one of my absolute favorites ever. I have passed it around through my family, my friends, and hopefully soon we'll be getting it back again from my dad. And one of the things that I was so struck by when I first read it was that I make it a point not to know what an author looks like, you know, before I read the first of their works that I've read. And I was just amazed at the depth and that you wrote from this woman's perspective. So that when I looked at your picture in the back jacket, I thought, wow, he looks like such a manly man.
Big old rough-hewn guy there.
Well,
and I was just even more astounded. But I love those. I love your writing, and those two, Dalva and The Road Home especially, are just my two favorites. I grew up in Wyoming, spent a lot of time in Nebraska, the Dakotas, all that. And so when I am away from home, like I am now, I love reading back on those books and having those images.
Rachel, what is it about Jim's writing that pulls you in so?
One of the things is that, like Louise Erdrich's books, they're so multi. The storylines are multi-generational, and I really, or at least in those two of my favorite in particular.
So you get some epic sweep going on there.
Yes, and I absolutely love that. It's the books I just cannot put down. I've reread Dalva, I think, about five or six times already.
Jim, what do you say to your fan?
You would be amused in France now. I've had my photo taken with at least 35 little Dalvas over the years.
Right.
The French love that novel. So there are all these photos around with me holding a little baby Dalva, which I find very amusing.
Jim, what about Rachel's dismay at seeing you, this big sort of two-fisted?
I was not dismayed.
No, but just at the, yeah, okay. But
but look, I once thought I'd written a piece for the New York Times about, I'm certain by far the first, look at Flaubert's Madame Bovary. No one ever entered the heart of a woman any further. Mm. That Dalva's certainly more positive, creature, but I think of my mother and her six sisters. I think of my two daughters, my wife, my female dogs, my female cats, my female horses when I was writing this. Well, and we all started, remember, we all started as girls for the first month or so.
Right. In the womb. Right.
I mean, Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist, said, what have we done? He addressed men saying, what have we done with our twin sister who we abandoned at birth? Mm. In other words, we have that side of ourselves, certainly. Mm. I mean, a profound female side. So you can, I can't say it was difficult to access at certain times while I was writing that book. Maybe. I had to behave a little better than usual.
Maybe, you know? The hunter and the fisherman who hangs with Jack Nicholson, but you've got it there. I wish you'd read a little more for us to keep this in our ear. There's a piece where he's raising this is the grandfather of Donald, has raised a bear cub. He talks here about Sally, the great draft horse, as well. Could you dive in there for us, Jim?
Okay, he raised a tiny bear cub after a hunter had shot the mother. She slept with him until she was three, except in winter. Then Clarence talked to her down the blowhole in the snowbank covering the deadfall where she hibernated. Her hot, slow breath melted this breathing hole, but so deep was her sleep she didn't hear him. This old Indian jokester in the area asked Clarence if he had made love to this bear, and Clarence said that, like many women, she plain didn't want to. She made love to a male bear, but stayed in the area and would visit Clarence and sit by the fire with her two cubs. He lived only a mile from Lake Superior, and they would share a pail of lake trout he he'd catch. Naturally, he called this bear Sally. Any dog or horse that lived with him the rest of his life, he called Sally. When he married this mixed-blood French-Canadian woman named Lucretia when he was 50, he also called her Sally. Clarence believed spirits were alive and moved in and out of creatures. Even birds could carry human spirits and vice versa. I have no proof of this, but it might be true. It's not for us to say no. One winter night, Clarence had a dream of horses. In the dream, there was a green pasture with many draft horses that were related to his old horse, Sally. There was a marsh nearby full of red-winged blackbirds, which have a song Clarence liked. So in April, he headed toward the southeast and worked at a sawmill in Ladysmith, Wisconsin, for a year to gather a little money. By the time Clarence left the woods, he was about tired of just eating fish and venison and the rutabagas, cabbages, carrots, and potatoes he grew in his garden. He had a craving for tomatoes, which are almost impossible to grow that far north. Once when Cynthia's tomatoes froze in mid-June on Sugar Island near the Sioux, she was steamed up about it all summer, and then in August drove a couple hundred miles to buy 5 bushels of the right kind of tomatoes, both to can and to make sauces for the freezer. If you want tomatoes, nothing else will do.
Jim Harrison reading from his new novel, Returning to Earth. The man who will sleep next to the bear and drive hundreds of miles for the right tomatoes. And I guess you've got both of those passions. The bear always comes back in your work, Jim. Is that a Native American icon?
Well, no, that's prefatory. You know, everybody sort of has their animal. And I lived around bears for a long time. And not to tread on where I'm not really welcome in Chippewa medicine. Bears, that's a tough medicine to have because a bear is maybe too powerful, but that's the kind of sort of medicine that Donald has, and that's why his daughter keeps... his daughter, Claire, Donald's daughter, Claire, is the only one that really simply can't accept her father's death at all, and that was certainly true in our family, when my father died rather early, that both my little brother and sister couldn't deal with it.
Chris is calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Chris, you're on the air with Jim Harrison in Denver.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm sorry to get off the subject on the idea of mortality, but it seems that Jim's novels are heavily reliant on this American, or maybe it's a universal idea of the love of the wild or the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly am. Many of the books I've read have that theme, but it bothers me that the society we live in today, this is not the America of today. You know, we don't have the wildness that we used to have. He talked about the mining and the logging in Michigan, and I just want to ask him what he thinks is the future of this type of novel. Does it require Americans to have a connection to the wilderness?
Jim?
Well, it's interesting. What I've found, and I'm not by nature an alarmist, partly because my dad was in soil and land, water conservation, so I've grown up with it for 60 years or so. But it must be remembered, in my own lifetime, our country has gone from 75% rural, 25% urban to, you know, the exact opposite. And I found literally hundreds of thousands of miles around the United States, I really found actually a great number of truly wild areas. I think you have to be a little more careful, and the true wild areas are not exactly in national parks. You know, they're sort of disregarded land. I think the mining and logging in the UP, you know, everybody had to make a living. But now that so much of it is gone, it's nobody can wild areas in the United States are usually areas that no one can make money out of anymore, if you get what I mean.
But Jim, what about Chris's question saying, as Americans have made the move you described there from rural to urban, what about the fate of novels like yours that are deeply rooted in that wild setting? Do readers still come to it? Do they still resonate with it less than before, more than before? What's your experience?
Well, I think, I know, for instance, in New England, Jeff Lent, who's a marvelous novelist, he lives up that in that Northern Kingdom area of Northern Vermont, and it certainly seems between there and the Canadian border. See, what I mean is a 40-acre woodlot can be pretty wild, you know.
But what about a 40-block stretch of urban America and readers there?
Well, that's not my place. It's a place that people have to move places for economic reasons, basically. But as far as the future, I think the future of the novel with this kind of basically outdoor setting is probably pretty vigorous, you know.
Chris in Connecticut, what do you say to that? Jim thinks it goes on. Does the mystique stand?
Well, I just look back as a teenager, you know, as a child, you know, I read Big Red and Jim Kjellgaard's work and The Yearling, you know, and it really built my persona. And now as an adult, you know, it doesn't apply to my making.
No, we can't retrieve that area. For instance, I felt melancholy in Mississippi 2 weeks ago because I was driving through the delta between Clarksdale and Greenwood. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the delta region of Faulkner's marvelous short novel, The Bear. But, of course, there aren't any bears there anymore. I mean, that place is pretty much spawned out. But I was just assuring you that there are a lot of areas that aren't spawned out. And, in fact, they've become depopulated with people moving to urban areas.
Including depopulated of readers. Chris, you raise a really interesting question there about where
I think so, too, because I've thought about the same thing in my an archaism already in my own lifetime, you know.
Ouch, but it's been a good one. Chris, thank you for that call. Let's go to Michigan, Petoskey, Michigan. This is getting close to the terrain of Jim Harrison's new novel. Alan is on the line. Hi, Alan, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Jim, absolute pleasure to talk to you. I've walked through a lot of the same sandy soil and probably waded a lot of the same streams that you have in the UP, and I think it's fantastic that we've got another writer outside of Hemingway that's actually tried to embody the stark landscape that's often hard to appreciate of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I think it's one of the last barren places, aside from maybe Alaska, that we have in the United States. And I actually got a chance to go fishing at Frenchman's Pond about 7 years back, which was a place that John Volker used to fish.
Yeah, I fished there, too.
Have you?
I used to go over to visit John occasionally, and it was always extraordinary because he also by noon made the largest Manhattans I've ever seen drink. So,
he was famous for his bourbon old fashions too. So,
yeah,
I wanted to know if you ever got a chance to meet John.
I spent some time with him. We did a Hemingway conference together as the keynoter, and it was funny because I've never felt particularly drawn to Hemingway, oddly enough, because I love to tell some people, well, he was just a tourist up here. You know what I mean?
With his Nick Adams stories up in that territory.
Yeah, yeah. But of course he's a marvelous writer, but I had some good times with John, you know. In fact, I looked at that movie, that Anatomy of a Murder, and it is simply an extraordinary movie, you know.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and he's not really known for that, so I think it's fantastic that you knew him, and I was just curious about that. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, Alan, thanks for calling in from the scene of the novel right there. It's not just about dying, but about mourning as well, and then finally coming back out of that And I should say, by the way, listeners, you can read an excerpt of Jim Harrison's Returning to Earth at our website, onpointradio.org. Jim, in the way that those closest to Donald, and particularly his wife, Cynthia, and remembering that she married essentially the gardener's son here and lived that very physical, that very earthy life with him, what are you pointing us to about mourning and dealing with death in the book?
Well, see, but Donald, after he got ill, he kept sort of half-teasing his wife. These people are down to earth saying, you better find yourself a boyfriend because I'm on the way out, you know.
And
Cynthia's, you know, a very physical woman. She's only in her mid-40s, so this can't be the end of her life, you know. Occasionally is, but maybe that's not a good idea.
There's a little passage you might read that illustrates that. Here's Donald's gone now, and she's been mourning and mourning and dealing with her family, but also in that being very practical-minded in her conversation with herself. There's a bit where the furnace has trouble. Could you read that for us, Jim?
Sure. At some point in the night, the furnace went off so that when I awoke at first light just before 7, the house was frightfully cold. I put on a full-length sheepskin coat Donald had given me for Christmas, made coffee, and waited for the furnace man I'd called to arrive. He turned out to be from the class behind me in high school, though I didn't remember him. After he had replaced what he called the igniter, I poured him a cup of coffee, and he showed me what was wrong with the defective part with his oily hands. Heat was flooding the kitchen, and I parted my coat. For an instant, my left breast peeked out of my nightgown, and we both blushed as I covered it. He left moments later, and it occurred to me as I watched him walk out to the van that if he had made a move, I doubt if I would have resisted. What could be erotic about oily hands and the scent of fuel oil? I had felt so naked beneath my robe and nightgown. I dressed as warmly as possible and went out to Clarence's work shed and got my cross-country skis and poles. I still tasted last night's vodka in my mouth, and my mind was unclear. I wanted to go to a wild area near Champion, but remembered it was deer season and didn't want to be mistaken for a doe. Presqu'île would be too windy, so I chose Trowbridge Park, skied for nearly 2 hours until I was soaked with sweat, but hadn't quite dispelled the image of the repairman's large, oily hands. My heart jumped at the idea that I'd forgotten the wire transfer for Kay and Polly, so I stopped at the bank and then picked up a steak at the IGA, remembering how easily Donald could eat a 2-pound porterhouse or a whole chicken, for that matter.
And there he is.
That's
again,
back to
Donald.
Physiology again.
to the very physical. Let's take a call from Provincetown, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on the air with Jim Harrison.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm honored to be able to speak to Jim Harrison. I've been a longtime reader, and I just love his books. And I just wanted to bring up the point that I think his real treasure, you know, your other caller was talking about the future of this kind of writing. I think the treasure of his writing is that it's a refuge from, you know, the advancement of the world, the way it's going. And in fact, I think that his books don't translate well into movies. I've seen two of them, and I was disappointed. And I think it brings up the fact that he's he paints, and, you know, the words he uses are like the cinema of the mind. Mm. And I think it's so rich and so wonderful. I just want to thank him for his wonderful books and continued writing.
I haven't liked any of the movies particularly myself, but it's very hard for a writer to like the movies. I was talking to Nicholson about our reaction to Legends of the Fall.
Your buddy Jack and Nicholson,
we agreed that it needed more blood and leather, and that maybe Aidan Quinn particularly did a beautiful job, but I kept thinking, gee, this ranch, what do they do? Have a French dry cleaner down the street? You know, everybody looked a little bit clean. Yeah.
And what about your work? Bruce reads it as the cinema of the mind.
Well, that's an interesting point, because when I started out in my teens, I desperately wanted to be a painter, you know, as a boy, and of course paint nude women like Modigliani.
Sure.
But I was an utter failure. But I majored even in art history, and I've always been an art obsessive. So the caller was very correct. I tend to paint. It's odd. I tend to paint every scene I write in an interior sense until I totally see, until I totally see where I am. You see what I mean?
Yes.
I have to do that in order to be able to write it.
And then there's the taste of everything as well. Richard's calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Richard, you're on the air with Jim Harrison.
Hi there.
Hi.
I've always enjoyed your work, and I particularly liked your columns for Esquire a few years back about food and cooking and wild game. Were those ever collected, or do you
yeah,
intend to kind of work in the future?
They're in a book. They're in a book called The Raw and the Cooked. In fact, Sevier magazine just had some comments about it. Yeah, they're available. Although I'm still writing sort of a strange food column for Toronto magazine that's run by Michael Ondaatje, this incredible Canadian novelist. And his magazine is called Brick. I've been writing a column for them, but a little off the wall.
Epicurean food with a wild streak, that Jim Harrison
food
streak.
And sex, food and God, food and spirituality, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's fun to turn loose.
Yeah,
you know?
Will Blythe reviewed Returning to Earth and looked back on a lot of your work. He says you've got rules for zestful living. The way he interprets you, Jim, you know, rule number one, eat well. Avoid ninny diets. Rule two, pursue love and sex no matter discrepancies of desire and age. Three, welcome animals, especially bears, ravens, and wolves, into your waking and dream life. Does he capture you there? Are you signing on to that?
A little bit, but of course it's absurd to not eat well, because you only have a limited number of meals in your life. Why do it poorly?
Yeah. And there's the living part at the end of this long meditation in this book. Did you find yourself readier, more eyes open toward the great beyond, Jim?
Well, no. I live in my characters. So, you know, this is difficult because I've created hundreds of characters. In fact, I often thought my Valhalla would be to go to an old farmhouse deep in the forest, and there would be all my beloved dead dogs and all the heroines of my novels.
All named Sally, like the draft horse?
Yes, right. Everybody would be there, that kind of thing. No, of course, this is a time in your life, you know, in your 60s and so on, when you're, well, I only have one eye, but when your eyes are wide open, you know. Well, I don't mind.
No, as Donald says, there's nothing that lives that doesn't die.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, you tend to see it more, human existence, as a continuum. I don't think anymore in terms of beginning, middles, and ends. In fact, my own background, philosophically, I don't think anyone's born or anyone dies, you know, in that respect.
We'll read to wrap our minds around that. You sure keep it going book after book, and we're grateful for it. The latest is Returning to Earth. Jim Harrison in Denver, we're very grateful for your time and for the new book. Thank you very much for talking with us this hour.
I enjoyed talking to you.
It's a pleasure. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.